Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast that 9 out of 10 Soviet sub-captains derisively tell their crews to listen to while conducting missile drill tests off the coast of America. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser.
So, yes, last week we took a look at a little film called Logan's Run, which co-starred one Richard Jordan. And we liked Richard Jordan so much that we decided to follow him to 1990, where he co-stars in a little film called The Hunt for Red October, John McTiernan's adaptation of the 1984 Tom Clancy novel. I gotta say, right off the bat, Andrew, first of all, welcome back for the show.
Always a pleasure to be here. I think maybe there will be a day where we try and record an episode as a straight monologue, but don't worry, dear listeners, that's not going to happen until David and I are absolutely desperate for content. How are you, Dave?
I'm not doing too bad. Like I said, it's nice to be taking a look at a film that I've selected that isn't, I think, innately terrible.
I think it's not a roll of the dice on this one, because both you and I, when we seem to have picked something blindly over the last couple weeks, it has come up snake eyes every single time.
Yeah, it's certainly been an interesting role. But hey, we've had some feedback. Some people have really seemed to dig what the show is. We've had people even offer to appear on the show, which is certainly something I wasn't anticipating offhand,
yeah,
and it's nice to hear.
I honestly thought, that I would probably have to start recording under a pseudonym, just because anytime somebody's like, oh, you do a podcast and stuff, I'm like, yeah. They're like, where can I listen to it? And then I have that moment of pause where I'm like, do I want the world to know that I'm an even bigger nerd than I appear to be?
And the answer should be always yes.
Exactly.
Absolutely yes.
Be true to yourself.
Exactly. Not to mention, if it's somebody who, I'll put it this way, if they manage to make it through 20 minutes of listening to us, you know what? That's great. If they can't make it through 20 minutes, we understand, and they probably were never looking to listen to our show in the first place. So again, thank you, listeners, for returning, and thank you for those who are providing feedback. It's great to hear. So, that brings us to the film for this week, The Hunt for Red October. And, man, is this going to be a discussion, I think.
It'll be interesting. I mean, I'm an avid news reader, so I feel like even without seeing this film, Russian spycraft and policy wonks talking about submarines, I feel like just reading headlines over the last month, I could be fully up to speed on this one. But unlike whatever you find in the newspaper, however, Red October comes out at a very interesting time in world history. Would you say that, Dave?
It is. This film is released in 1990, and as I noted earlier, is based on a book from 1984. And that time frame, those 6 years, are very fascinating to consider, because at the time the book is written, it is a timely novel about, you know, Cold War politics and spy, as Andrew's referenced here, spycraft going on. By 1990, things have already shifted rather significantly. This is a case where, depending upon how you want to classify the end of the Cold War, it has either happened or is just about to happen.
Yeah, I think generally people point to the fall of the Berlin Wall, at least, as the beginning of the end. Pretty much everything that followed was more or less a formality. And yeah, my understanding is this film, the filming was complete when the wall was still up, but by the time it was released theatrically, the wall had fallen.
Because the wall falls down in 89, and this film definitely doesn't come out till 1990. So this is happening right at the time that, you know, the Soviet tensions, or the tensions between the Soviet Union and America, were basically collapsing. And more to the point, right at the time the Soviet Union itself is collapsing, as the Eastern Bloc revolutions are going on, which results in the Berlin Wall, as we've mentioned, and ultimately to the dissolution of the USSR itself in 1991. So what we have here is kind of the last of the great Cold War thrillers of the pretty much of the Cold War period. But even then, this is a film that has to position itself as a period piece setting itself in 1984.
Well, I think that's a very shrewd move, though, because the moment that you're making any kind of historical fiction or even a period drama, it's probably more of a problem with, like, historical fiction, depending on how the future unfolds. But there's always that risk that the content of your film will end up becoming irrelevant to some degree. Like, I can imagine anybody... over the last 2 years deciding to be like, I'm going to make a documentary about how Al Franken is America's greatest legislator and things like that. And by the time it comes out, it's like, oh, well, I have a 90-minute film to show you if you're curious. Whereas this film, it does something very... It does a number of deliberate things with how it frames itself as a narrative that, in some respects, it circumvents that problem of irrelevance while at the same time, like, being fully in tandem with what was then contemporary developments.
Absolutely. And before we go even further down that line, I mean, that's one of the key strands we're going to pull out over the course of this episode. It's also worth examining this because... to look at the figure of Tom Clancy, or more specifically, Tom Clancy's work, and what would come out of this. Because it's one thing that we should note here is that I think when you say the name Tom Clancy today, most people will have probably a pretty good idea as to what you're talking about. They are either...
ball cap, big glasses, always at the pharmacy.
Yes, yes. The late Tom Clancy, an author... who became known for his spy thriller novels featuring the character of Jack Ryan. Again, Hunt for Red October was the first one published, and pretty much Clancy went overnight from being this little-known author to a major bestseller, which would then lead to him writing a whole string of novels and what became dubbed as the techno-thriller genre. And... this is kind of an interesting thing to worth consider, because what the heck exactly do we mean when we say techno-thriller, Andrew? Do you care to take a guess or, you know, contextualize it for us there?
Well, in the case of Clancy, I would say he almost falls into the territory that a writer like Michael Crichton occupies, where they're writing fairly pulpy stories, but whereas someone like Robert Ludlum will sort of keep it at potboiler sort of magic realism level. Dan Brown maybe would be another example of that. Tom Clancy is a writer that tries to ground everything he does by using as much technical and real world detail as humanly possible. So the idea is that it's the story that's being told is still kind of fluffy or Hollywood-esque, but there's this level of detail, sometimes at the cost of excitement, where, yeah, I mean, it's not just a case where operations team kicks down a door and takes down the suspect. Instead, you get 30 pages of it prior as they're planning out the raid, they're getting the proper clearances from, like, the relevant jurisdiction and all of that. So... There's a lot of deliberate use of military speak, of operational terminology, and military hardware described in loving detail as well. So the idea is that, okay, this is the thinking man's page turner.
Yeah, which is a dubious distinction, I think. Anytime I hear the word thinking man's whatever, I become very suspicious of the work we're going to be talking about. But in the case of Clancy, to give him some credit, and I know Clancy's a bit of a controversial figure in terms of his politics, looking at him in terms of his craft, I think one of the things that we can give him is that if you are kind of a policy or tech wonk, these things are... his books are fascinating. And I think, you know, he was really good at creating these sort of elaborate scenarios and plot lines where there are multiple moving pieces at a distance from one another and sort of capturing in relatively clear terms the chaos that goes with that and how these things don't necessarily neatly line up and intersect there and how that ends up influencing things. So the novels end up in this weird position where they're halfway between being like an Ian Fleming pulp novel, but then they're in some ways even, you know, a little bit closer to something like Jean Le Carré's noteworthy, you know, intricately plotted works. And they sort of, you know, exist in that weird ground, which I think will be very fascinating when we suddenly get into the notion of Clancy's Jack Ryan novels becoming a feature film franchise and how that, you know, corresponds with what The Hunt for Red October does to that, well, and how it's...
And a video game franchise as well. The series Rainbow Six, Ghost Recon. Yeah. They were actually my first introduction to the name Tom Clancy. And again, like, for a whole generation of computer gamers, it's almost like we were introduced to Tom Clancy through very action-packed, squad-based tactical shooters. So I remember as a kid, like being 14, 15, finding a copy of Rainbow Six and being like, awesome, the back of the jacket talks about like international terrorist plot. And I'm like, so far, so good. And then it's like 800 pages of all these independently moving parts and basically having to like grid out on a piece of paper what's going on in what plot line. So it gets very complicated, but in doing so, it also reflects like the staggering complexity of American and international bureaucracies as well.
Yeah, and that's kind of been, you know, that's really the big challenge when you look at the Jack Ryan film adaptations, is how they either succeed or struggle with capturing how that works here. And, you know, certainly I think, to tip my hat in advance, A, when we get to The Hunt for Red October, I'm going to say unabashedly, I love this movie. And I think there are very specific reasons why this film works so much better than the bulk of what would come afterwards in terms of these adaptations. And, you know, I think a lot of that comes down to the central hook of this film and the way in which it's structured.
Maybe that's a good opportunity to submerge ourselves and take a look at the film proper. So, yes, as you mentioned, Hunt for Red October, originally written in 1984, and now the film comes out in 1990. So what happens between there and here?
So basically, in terms of the production background of this film, it was optioned by producer Mace Neufeld in 1985, and was aiming to make this thing into a film quite quickly, because as he saw it, this was a potential blockbuster. Certainly the novel had been a major success. However, it took him quite a bit of time to try and get this thing made, mainly supposedly because studio executives kept thinking that this thing was going to be too complicated for mainstream audiences to understand, and that it would simply just bore people to tears. Through preservation, he eventually convinced Paramount Studios to attach themselves to the project, which I guess makes sense when you consider this is the studio that would ultimately, or had made, or would go on to make things like Flight of the Intruder, and eventually the Mission Impossible franchise as well, and sort of having that grounding in quote-unquote adult thrillers or political military thrillers. I mean, even Top Gun, certainly, which is one of their productions, fits into that mold. The film ends up being heavily, goes through a number of drafts. It's initially written by Larry Ferguson and Donald E. Stewart, with some uncredited work done by John Milius on the sections of the movie set aboard the Red October. Don't worry, folks, we'll get into a plot recap here soon enough. And the film eventually starts casting. Numerous names end up becoming attached to this thing at various points. For a while, very close to filming, Klaus Maria Brandauer was going to play the role of Captain Marco Ramius in the film. Apparently, from what I can tell, he broke his leg very close to the production standpoint, and it was him who suggested that they get his co-star from Never Say Never Again, the unofficial canon Bond movie, Sean Connery, to come in and play Ramius instead.
That kind of feels like an excuse, because, I mean, you're playing a submarine captain, you have a broken leg, it's like, okay, well, why don't we just film all your scenes sitting? Oh, wait, but then they couldn't stand on the boat at the end. Go on.
Yes. Also cast around this time, and supposedly before Connery, is one up-and-coming actor named Alec Baldwin in the role of CIA analyst Jack Ryan, who becomes quickly involved with the events. Again, plot description coming, folks, here, which is interesting because at a point this film was also offered to Harrison Ford, who apparently thought that the film more favored the Ramius role and turned it down on those regards. And that's funny because Ford would go on to play Ryan in the sequels to this movie. More on that later. And certainly Kevin Costner at one point in time was also offered the role of Jack Ryan, which again, makes a lot of sense when you consider that he was a major star throughout the 1980s, and certainly appeared in things, films such as No Way Out, also associated with Cold War thriller, another Cold War thriller. Funny enough, also like Harrison Ford, he would go on to appear in another Jack Ryan movie years later, Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit, not in the role of Ryan, however.
Oh, that was a film that happened.
Yeah, and probably
the I completely forgot about that one until you just mentioned it, to be honest.
As, well, yeah, as most people have, for kind of good reason. And we should note, you know, Jack Ryan is coming back on Amazon streaming service late this month for the Jack Ryan TV series starring John Krasinski.
Yeah, what has two thumbs and top-level CIA clearance? This guy.
Yeah, so, so yeah, eventually this film is made, released. It's directed by John McTiernan, who that's a name you probably recognize because he had directed such hits as Predator and a little film called Die Hard in 1988, starring
Bruce
Willis.
Still the best action movie ever made.
Yes, it's certainly, if not the best, it is certainly fighting for the top spot.
And he did The Running Man as well, right?
No, he did not. That was, no, that's not him. He would do, that was, who was it? I want to say it was it Mark Paul Glazer? Let me double check here.
I'm okay not knowing. I guess I had a mandala effect thing going on. But yeah, so there's some heavy hitters attached to this project. So, I mean, as you said, Neufeld, he hung on to the book rights for 6 years trying to get this movie made. And if he saw it as a blockbuster, a franchise starter, maybe, maybe not, we'll get into that. He certainly set up the project to come out swinging. And, I mean, when you're also building a film around Sean Connery, who in 1990 certainly still has a pretty high degree of cultural cachet, this is a project that, by all initial indicators, seems like prepared to be successful and prepared to deliver on that potential.
And deliver it did. This film ended up grossing, if I'm not at the amounts I've seen, close to $200 million worldwide. Was critically acclaimed, and, you know, Connery, it's funny you say his cultural cachet, because by the late 80s and into the early 90s, he's back on an upswing after a less than great 1970s and early 80s, for the most part. And, you know, this is one of the big films that kept Connery a mega star throughout the 1990s. Because it wasn't certainly a film he would star in a year later, but we'll get to that another time. But, yeah, what in this instance, yeah, I mean, this is an incredibly successful film. So, I mean, and it's not just a successful movie, but I would say of all the films that are based on Clancy novels, this is the one that endures more than any other. This is the one we keep coming back to. It's the one that people remember, and it's the one that's still celebrated this many years on. And I guess the question becomes, why is that the case, and is it deserved?
Honestly, the answer may be as simple as it's just the most nuanced. Like, it, as we signposted earlier, the narrative does a number of things that sort of insulates itself against the tide of history. Whereas, if you look at some of the subsequent ones, The Sum of All Fears with Ben Affleck, for instance, that is a film where everything gets reduced to good and evil, and it just plays out from there. Whereas, like, it almost feels like it's oversimplified, which, again, is hard to say in a Tom Clancy book. Like, even his grocery lists are probably, like, 15 pages long. But this is a film where, yeah, it does sort of explore issues in a bit more complexity, because Cold War narratives are also not unique in throughout the 1980s, certainly not by 1990. But again, you look at films like, Gorky Park or something like that. It's the Soviet Union is very, they make for a very effective shorthand for on-screen villainy. So you have a film like Red Dawn, where it's just, they're the faceless evildoers. But then in a film like this, it's not to say that the Soviet Union is necessarily heroized, but It draws distinctions between nations and individuals, between larger systems and like the people working within them. And I think in doing so, like it comes off as a lot more even-handed and far less reactionary than certainly the other Ryan films and a lot of techno thrillers that are kind of inspired by this approach.
Yeah, so I guess this is probably a good point to get into the plot of the film, which right off the bat, let's put it this way. In the broad strokes of this film has got a great hook for a thriller. And the basic gist of it is Sean Connery is playing Marco Ramius, a Soviet captain who is taking out the Red October, a experimental new sub with a Caterpillar drive, which is ostensibly this, you know. The film doesn't go into deep explanations as to exactly how it functions, much probably to Clancy's chagrin. But in this instance, it's a drive that is basically designed to allow the sub to run about as close to silent as it can get. And in theory, manage to navigate its way through U.S. waters for the potential to launch a nuclear missile should the need ever arise.
Yeah, I mean, that's literally all we're told, but it's also all that we really need to be told.
Precisely. The thing is that Marco Ramius isn't really intending to use this maiden test voyage for that purpose. For reasons that become clearer over the course of the film, he and his handpicked team of officers have decided to defect to the United States. And they have come up with this plan that we're not entirely included in on the details to drive the sub to American waters without the Soviet, at least as far as the officers are concerned, without the Soviet Union knowing, hand over the sub and defect there, and hopefully pull this off without either getting blown out of the water by the Americans or getting caught by the Soviets. The thing is, Ramius is part of is an effort to encourage his crew and to kind of make a point to the so to his Soviet overlords. Basically, mails a letter to what we discover is his uncle, who's a high-ranking Soviet officer, about what his plan is once they're in the water, which suddenly turns the Soviet fleet on him and basically has them patrolling the waters and heading close to the Americans in order to try and blow him out of the water before he can get there.
In hindsight, maybe he shouldn't have sent that letter. It's like Liz Taylor
Maybe.
in the VIPs. But yeah, so there's almost this double deception going on. Whereas the American State Department, they are being told by the Russians that Ramius has gone rogue and that with his silent sub, he's going to carry out a renegade unauthorized nuclear strike on the United States. They have to catch him, they have to destroy the boat. The Russians, they also know that he's going to defect, so they're trying to chase him while at the same time playing international politics. And so, yes, Ramius is caught between these two forces, but there's also another plot going on, and that brings us to Jack Ryan.
And who is Jack Ryan? Well, he is an academic and former Marine. If I'm remembering correctly, a one-time Marine who, due to a back injury, has basically comfortably pushed himself into the life of academia and acting as a CIA analyst. As the film gets started, he has basically been provided with photos that the CIA has been supplied with of this Caterpillar drive and is trying initially to determine what is this thing and is seeking to sort of look out and find experts to help him figure this out. What quickly becomes the case, though, as tends to happen in these kinds of films, he gets dragged into the higher echelons of power to basically provide information as the Ramius situations breaks out, and quickly comes up with a theory as he recognizes the important dates under which this is happening, that Ramius might just be trying to defect to the United States. The key for him, though, is trying to get people in power to listen to him. And while he is certainly not wanting to go into the field in order to prove this, he basically, his side of the film ends up becoming a matter of he's got a set dead line to try and convince the people who are within the positions of power to make decisions to listen to him to give Ramius a chance because maybe, just maybe, Ramius is actually doing what we know him to be doing as the audience in this film. And basically the film becomes kind of a ticking clock movie where it's divided into two very clear spheres where you have Ramius not only trying to navigate to not getting blown out of the water, but keep the crew of the ship in line and oblivious to what's actually going on.
Yes, while a saboteur is on the boat disrupting the equipment at every turn.
Absolutely. And then you have Ryan, who's basically running from place to place, person to person, and getting further and further into the field. Just not, you know, as a big action hero, but basically just trying to sell people, okay, I got this crazy notion, but you're going to want to listen to me because I think it might actually be what's going on. And doing his best to convince a group of actually reasonable, level-headed experts at their jobs that they might want to, you know, not take the situation at face value there. And I gotta say, you know, this film structurally is so good as a film here because of the way in which there are multiple layers of tension going on and situations that arrive throughout it. And credit where credit's due to the script and to director John McTiernan. There are a lot of moving pieces in play in this story that could easily have gone awry in a lesser hands, but he keeps things relatively crystal clear, sharp, and going as far as things, and, you know, well-paced as the film goes far, so that the audience doesn't really lose the threads as they go throughout this movie.
Yeah, it's I think it's a combination of the scripting and the editing of this film, but it maintains that parallel structure pretty closely. It's not like all of a sudden we'll have half an hour where Ryan's just off somewhere. Usually, like, there's a pretty steady sense of alternation, and more importantly, whatever's happening in either of the plots, they always operate sort of in tandem. So one informs the other, rather than starting out at completely opposite ends narratively and then concluding by meeting in the middle. There's sort of an ongoing sense of development across both arcs at all times. And as a result, like, even when we get to scenes where, you know, they're simply taking a helicopter and talking about, you know, how this operation's going to go, like, not much is happening, but it always feels engaging.
Well, precisely. And the thing that's funny is, again, this film could very easily be lopsided as well, because the stuff with Ramius is, I think, innately more dramatic than what's going on with Ryan, in the sense that he's on a sub, he's driving this thing, there is a saboteur on board. They're constantly having to lie to the crew and give them false information and work his way through. And again, if the film had just been that, that would be great. The stuff with Ryan is much trickier to handle because, again, what we're basically given as his plot thread is this is a guy who wants to get into rooms to talk to other people over and over and over again. And that could very easily, particularly in a sort of cinematic sense for a thriller, end up being treated very offhandedly or like dead air, as it were, and just be the boring stuff.
The one good civil servant, you know? But as you mentioned, though, I think part of why it's also interesting is the way that it would be very easy to do that narrative where there's the one sensible person and everybody else is just like a closed-minded reactionary. Like, we've seen that narrative happen before, especially in military type films, where like everybody's just acting out in like broad strokes and refusing to listen to anything. You know, we know what those kinds of films are, and that's not what happens here, though, because instead it's not so much trying to change people's minds as much as trying to get people in positions of power to see the nuance of situations. And that's a very interesting move regarding like what Ryan as a character does in this film, because his great victory is not really, it's not that he defuses the bomb at the last second, or that he picks up an M60 and then guns down the entire terrorist cell. It's really his arc and his victory is convincing people to think about other details and recognize his line of thinking. And as a result, like, especially coming out of the 1980s and from a director like John McTiernan, it's interesting how Ryan, as like the male action hero, is positioned against that, because he's not this hyper-masculine figure. He doesn't have like this amazingly sculpted body on display, and he doesn't rely on brute strength. Like, in a lot of ways, he is that action hero for the 90s middle-class audience. He's a career man, he's a civil servant, he's got a family at home, and he's a knowledge worker.
Well, precisely, and I think this is kind of where this film ends up being weird when you consider that this is a franchise starter by any way you look at it. I mean, because of the success of this movie, there would be not one, but two direct sequels to it, efforts to relaunch it, one which was maybe not critically as successful as its predecessors, but certainly was still a huge box office success, and a later one which we've all forgotten about because it basically does everything about as far from what we consider the things that make a Tom Clancy film a Tom Clancy film, as it were. And, you know, that's kind of interesting. But what's striking about this film is it's a franchise launcher where basically all the things that really brought people to it in the first place are almost constantly removed by the time you get to film two in it. And that's kind of the weird part. I think that's worth considering when we look at this because, first of all, this is not a film that was marketed or, in terms of its narrative, sold on being a franchise movie. It is... First of all, let's take a look at this. This is a movie that's called The Hunt for Red October. And who is the character and actor that's primarily positioned in this movie?
Yeah, look at it's the Sean iconic Con- poster. It's only Connery and the submarine. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's the thing where, it's Connery, it's the submarine. Connery gets top billing. Baldwin plays second fiddle in that. And somebody might point and say, well, Batman did the same thing in 1989 with Michael Keaton playing second fiddle to Jack Nicholson's Joker in terms of billing and arguably screen time. But the thing about it is that when you look at that film, Keaton's still playing the title character of that movie. Batman's still an established figure with iconography that goes with him and makes him, you know what to expect when you see a Batman movie. You know that there's going to be that costume. There's going to be the mythology of Bruce Wayne that follows it through. You're going to have the Batmobile show up. You're going to have the Batcave. You're going to have, you know, Gotham City and everything that goes with it. Hunt for Red October isn't really structured to establish a quote-unquote Jack Ryan iconography or mythology or anything really in this movie.
And even though the Ryan novels have sold well, like, I think it would be difficult to argue that audiences, mainstream audiences, seeing the poster for this film going into it, would have any kind of fully formed expectation of what a Jack Ryan story should be. You know, it is working within an established literary franchise, but I also don't think... I honestly don't think that most audiences going to see this in 1990 would have necessarily been aware of that.
Well, that's exactly it. In this film, when you look at the marketing campaign that came out for it and the way in which this film structured, it plays like a one-off. And I'm happy about that. I'm happy because this is a standalone movie that's great on its own terms. It's just when you consider what ends up spinning out from it, almost it's kind of fascinating to see how much of a nothing about this film corresponds to what we consider a traditional franchiser. I mean, let's even take a look at this in terms of its closest possible equivalent at the time, which is the James Bond franchise. I mean, not just because of the Sean Connery connection, but you take a look at Dr. No, and that film very shrewdly does a number of things off the bat to establish that, look, yeah, if this film works on its own, great, but there's stuff that we can come back to time and again that will sort of unify this as a series. Not only do we have an actor under contract to keep appearing in these things, you know, we're going to give him a theme tune that you're going to quickly recognize. You know, again, I love the score for Hunt for Red October, but if you could want to point to me what the Jack Ryan theme is, I couldn't tell you necessarily.
Odds are it's going to be really bombastic.
Yeah. If you, you know, it establishes very quickly, go-to tropes that they could go, Bond, James Bond, or Shaken, Not Stirred. Like, those things get introduced quickly, and there's a supporting cast that's going to work out. There is one supporting character in this film that returns for the sequels, and that is James Earl Jones as the deputy director of the CIA, Greer. And, again, watching this movie, Greer isn't necessarily a significant figure in the sense of, he's Jack's boss and comrade in arms and all these things. He's the guy that Jack reports to and who seems to have a bit of fun throwing Jack into the deep end just to see, how he sort of awkwardly responds to things.
Yeah.
But that's it.
Because there is that relationship, though, of sort of hierarchy where Jack is subordinate to the deputy chief. But I can see them very easily making another version of this film where they really double down on, like, oh, he's my mentor, he's sort of my father figure. That is what we get in The Sum of All Fears between Ben Affleck and Morgan Freeman's character. It's not quite developed here, and I don't necessarily mean that as a criticism. It's more that there will be scenes where, like, Ryan comes in and he suddenly has a breakthrough. He realizes what Ramius is up to. And James Earl Jones, just the way he plays the character, like, has that little faint smile. And he's not shutting him down. He's not saying, I believe you, now you have to tell everybody. He just gets that, like, wry little smirk. And he's like, go on, Ryan. Explain. And so he ends up being, like, more this Socratic figure than anything. That, like, he's there to challenge Ryan, but never cross over into, like, anything grandiose. But I like the subtlety of that. I think it leads to a couple scenes that actually are very charming. Again, you're right, though. It's not like this is a film that ends with them about to sail into harbor, and all of a sudden another Russian sub pops in, and then, Baldwin and Connery turn to the screen and say, here we go again! There's nothing that directly opens this up either to a direct sequel or to an established, like, world beyond the characters that are just introduced.
Well, precisely. And, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I think one of the things that this film also nails correctly that the sequels would go on and get wrong is the fact that Ryan is just an operative within a larger structure. And, let's put it this way. It's understandable why a lot of the American, military structure and political system is challenged, because it should be, because there is quite a bit of it that's wrong with it, and that is certainly deeply, deeply problematic. I think the one thing that Clancy's in both his novels and in this film in particular get right is the idea that what we're dealing with is professionals. And these are professionals who, they have a job to do, and they're going to do it to the best of their ability. And that means, we may not all get along, but we're all going to listen to each other. Now, is that probably a utopic presentation of how actual operations go? Absolutely. And I don't think anybody would question the notion that, Tom Clancy was very much a huge boaster for the American military forces. And I mean, it's certainly telling when, the Navy gave direct support to the production of this movie, or the fact that even the sequels, the CIA at least let them film in their front foyer.
For those wondering where Tom Clancy stands on militarism, well, you don't build an entire cottage industry writing about the cool stuff that the Army has if you don't approve of it.
Well, precisely. And that's the thing. And, there are reasons certainly to take Clancy's politics to task, or at least question, the amount of nuance he has towards the structure there. Because, I mean, on one hand, you get to things like Clear and Present Danger, where there is certainly, I think he has issues with the politics of America and how politics work. But that's not the same thing of saying he suddenly, is a free-thinking libertarian, or, has a liberal mindset towards things. Because I'm relatively sure Clancy would never go that far. I mean, this is the guy who I mean, the way in which his novels progress, Ryan becomes a Republican presidential candidate.
Yeah, I have actually read Executive Action, and I was going to point out that, like, the moment that Jack Ryan is the president, and you get, like, 80 pages of him meeting with, like, ministers and that, talking about why we need to reform the United States tax code, stuff like that, it's like, tell us what you're really thinking, Tom.
Well, and it's the thing, and I think, you know, there are many things you can really take to Clancy to task for. I think, you know, in the broad strokes, I think the thing that, you know, at least as a reader that I enjoy about his work is the notion of, okay, let's see these systems when they work right. And when they are at least, you know, functioning in a way where we seem to be dealing with reasonable people, which I think is kind of fascinating when you come back to the Ryan figure, particularly as he's played in this film by Alec Baldwin, because, you know, Baldwin is a, it's not just the fact that he is believable as an academic and a guy who seems desperately over his head, something that I think Harrison Ford really struggles with when you see him in the sequels having taken over the role. It's also the fact that, you know, Baldwin is, you know, I think it's, as most of us know, there is a fairly, you know, staunch, you know, liberal, as it were, Hollywood liberal as it may be, but certainly, you know, he's been very vocal about his politics, and here he is playing what is ostensibly the embodiment of Tom Clancy's entire ethos in this film. And it's that weird tension that I think almost makes it appealing, because you don't get the sense that Ryan in this film, like, I don't want to say that he's apolitical, but you almost get the sense that he is, to a degree, in this movie.
Well, because he's concerned with the truth. He's concerned with knowledge and the facts. So the way the character's presented, he kind of gets a pass, because it's like, you know, he's not interested in debating whether or not there's merits to the Soviet Union's philosophy or anything like that. It's, politics aside, there's a situation that I've been tasked with analyzing. Here's how I read it. Here's what I think is going down. You need to listen to me.
Precisely. And again, it ends up being a, it works here. And it, I mean, again, Baldwin, credit where credit's due, he really carries his half of the film exceptionally well in those things where, again, I mean, you're given a character who by could very easily end up being terribly boring in handled in the incorrect way, or be, could be even reduced just to the guy who spouts exposition at the audience over and over and over again. And that's not what Baldwin does here. He gets, I mean, there's an energy and an enthusiasm.
It's like a pluckiness, you know?
Yeah.
And comparing him to Ben Affleck's take on the character, some of all fears, like, Ryan is presented as sort of like this bright-eyed youngster who's very naive, but is also like, you know, he's a knowledge worker as well, but that kind of comes off as being more of a smartass than anything. Whereas Ryan in this film, Baldwin walks the line well, where it's like, he is out of place amongst all these people. He is like a brainy, bookish guy in a field full of actors, you know? But at the same time, like, he's quirky and he's sort of off the cuff, but he's baseline professional enough that it's like, oh, so this is why you also have your job in the first place. And I feel like most films come down on one side of that balance, whereas this is the only one that maintains that balance.
Well, exactly. And that's the thing that each of the subsequent films lose, because when you get to Patriot Games, which I rewatched prior to this podcast as well, it's stunning watching Harrison Ford in that role, because he is so out of place there. And I know there's a whole section of people who love Harrison Ford as Jack Ryan, but it doesn't click for me, because it's too easy to buy him as an authority figure. It's too easy to buy him as the guy that people are going to listen to, because he's a movie star. He brings that baggage with him. Alec Baldwin, by the time that this film comes out, you know, his biggest role is arguably in Beetlejuice, where, again, he's playing like second or third fiddle to Michael Keaton in that movie. I mean, Geena Davis is arguably the bigger star than him as well as far as that film's concerned. I mean, and that's the case where when you look at the trajectory of Baldwin's career, there are some efforts to make him into an action hero as things go forward, and you end up with things like The Shadow or The Getaway there. But ultimately, Baldwin's a character actor and supporting player more so than anything else. And that's a benefit to this role here that, again, you know, Harrison Ford doesn't have, Alec Baldwin, Ben Affleck doesn't have, and Chris Pine, God bless him, I mean, he's asked to play a character that's pretty much Ryan in name only. So, I mean, it's not even sure whether it's fair to compare him.
Yeah. But I think it is a testament to the film and how both the character of Ryan is written and performed that I will be totally frank. I'm a leftist. I can't stand Alec Baldwin. I think he's said and done a lot of things that are deeply problematic. And I feel like, you know, as you said, Hollywood liberalism, I think he's gotten a free pass on a lot of it because a lot of people overstate the importance of pointing out that the president says dumb things on TV sometimes. But here, like, it is very often very hard for me to separate, like, those personal feelings and just sit down and watch a movie. I was surprised at how much I really liked Baldwin's performance here. Yeah. And, like, I can see why, coming off of this, producers like Neufeld or whoever else wanted to do it would be like, cool, well, this was a big hit and we have the blueprint. But you're also very right, where in all the subsequent films, they recast it and they recharacterized it, which, you know, that also probably explains why, you know, the franchise, none of the following films ever hit the heights that this one did, either critically or commercially.
Well, exactly. And I mean, it's notable what doesn't come back. You don't bring back John McTiernan, you end up with, why am I blanking now on who directed the Philip Noyce for the next two films? And Noyce takes this weird pseudo-somber approach for Patriot Games, which tries to more and more, you know, play it like, oh, this is a serious, you know, dramatic thriller. And I think the thing that ends up resulting in why McTiernan is far more successful is, as well, is the tone of Hunt for Red October versus that. Because when you look at Patriot Games, the more somber you play the material, the more the Hollywoodisms and goofiness sort of comes out. Whereas McTiernan, what, you know, is very much playing in this pulp atmosphere. And it helps that he has Jean de Bont cinematography, which has, you know, the film doesn't look like a comic or anything like that, but there's this colorfulness and pulpiness to the way in which he shoots this movie, where, yeah, we're on a submarine, but you have these interesting camera angles and canted takes, and everything's just heightened enough.
Yeah, and there's a good sense of fluidity in the pacing, because again, like, McTiernan has cut his teeth doing, like, the bombastic action films of the 80s. Jan de Bont, cinematography, like, it's no coincidence that he would later make films like Twister and Speed. Like, this is someone who knows how to film things in a stylized and exciting way. And, you know, so even in the torpedo scene near the climax, where it could just be a bunch of guys staring at a screen as the sonar approaches, and that can be done well, like the motion tracking in the film Alien, for instance. But instead, there's that cross-cutting, overlapping dialogue, really rapid editing of various people in various locations, all basically intensely concentrated on the same thing. So there's this sense of oral fluidity, visual fluidity, things are constantly happening. But to the point where you take a step back and you realize, wow, what's actually going on isn't all that interesting, but the way it's presented makes it seem really fascinating.
Well, and that's it. I think this is, again, the key with McTiernan versus Clancy's prose, because, again, with Clancy, you're right, he would spend page after page detailing, you know, procedure and technology and how it functions and how it works and why it works. And that would be the death knell for any film going forward. What McTiernan does is really emphasize that pulpier side. And yeah, there's a tech fetish to this movie in terms of, hey, look at this stuff. Isn't this cool?
The plot at heart is about effectively a magic submarine. So, I mean, you can't subtract that entirely.
Well, exactly. But then you get to things like the way in which, you know, again, the interior of the Red October itself is this sort of high tech, you know, slick space that you're sort of navigating. And it, you know, like, again, part and parcel of why it's interesting is because it looks cool. I mean, it's this very, it's not just here is a rundown sub or this, dirty gray area. It is, slick. I mean, we're not watching Das Boot, which is trying to give you, here's the grimy reality.
Yeah. As a visual counterpoint, I think that's a really effective comparison to make, because again, like this film, most of its settings are interior spaces underwater or like committee rooms. And yet, because of the way that it's presented on screen, it often feels like a lot more interesting than it is. Like, it needs to be stylized to some degree. Otherwise, you get that very dry Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy effect, where it's like, well, this is all very complicated, and it's visually uninteresting. How much longer until the credits? This is a film with a lot on the go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, we haven't even gotten to other things like the supporting cast in this movie. Because again, in terms of, hey, we could go anywhere if we really wanted to after this movie. Let's just list the names we have working on this. We've already mentioned Connery. We've already mentioned Alec Baldwin. But let's not forget, there's Sam Neill as Borden, which is basically Remus' second in command. You've got Scott Glenn as Commander Mancuso, the one driving the American sub that Ryan has to get onto, that finds a way to track the Red October. You have, Courtney B. Vance as the sonar officer who figures out how to track
Jonesy. You have Tim Curry playing a more or less like a straight dramatic performance as the doctor on board the Red October.
Yeah. You have James Earl Jones, who we've mentioned, his career. You have Richard Jordan, who is a pure delight, and his small role as, Secretary of State Jeffrey Pelt.
Yeah, I loved him in this movie. And considering I don't think I had seen a Richard Jordan film prior to Logan's Run, he's rapidly emerging as one of the best takeaways from doing this show so far.
Yeah, he's great. He gets to play off of Josh Ackland, everybody's go-to for, Soviet types, as Ambassador Lysenko. Who, is, the sort of stuffy, uncomfortable Russian ambassador to the United States, who has to peddle these very unrealistic lies that he wants to get everybody to buy into. You got Fred Thompson as Rear Admiral Painter, who gets that delightfully over-the-top line about, it's only gonna get worse, as you see a plane sort of crash land onto a freighter. Yes, there's scumbag Jeffrey Jones in this movie, who, talking about people who I can't separate personal feelings from their work, I will say, he gives a fine performance in this movie for the 2 minutes he's on screen. That doesn't make him any less of a pure scumbag that I wish wasn't here.
Without having the Jeffrey Jones argument again, I think, though, even his position in the film shows that, like, it's a big cast, largely with character actors, and even though, the film, Ryan and Ramius are the centerpieces of this film. They are the only characters given any kind of a real degree of depth or development, but at the same time, like all the other actors that pop up, they know exactly what they're playing. Like, they're all sort of given an archetype, but they all do it really well. So this is a film that's full of like those 5 minutes of screen time roles that somebody just like, like Jordan, like Curry, they all just pop up, do what's needed, and it works really well. Like, in a lot of ways, this feels kind of like a Clockwork film, where it's all sort of built to a certain type, but everything's exactly in the right place. And so there's a certain joy in just watching it work in tandem.
Absolutely. Although it should be noted here, there's probably one thing you might be noticing in terms of the names we've been listing that we haven't mentioned there. And do you want to take a guess as to what that might be, Andrew?
You got me, Dave.
Women!
Oh, yes!
Where are the women in this film? And if you want, it feels weird because, first of all, there is one female role in this, or woman's role in this film, and that is Gates McFadden from Star Trek The Next Generation as Dr. Caroline Ryan.
But we also Jack's get wife. Dialogue from Jack's daughter as well. So we've this doubled the number.
Yeah, of course, all their dialogue happens in, like, the first 3 minutes of this movie. And out of its 135-minute runtime, that's it. And it's... Yeah, it's really... On one hand, if this film were made today, I can guarantee at least several key roles would probably be gender-swapped, and rightfully so. I could see probably, I would imagine, maybe the role of Mancuso would be switched. Or, you know, the Secretary of State Pelt would be altered there. I mean, it should be. So, yes, at the same time, this is also a film that's coming out of a very hyper-masculine period in film history. So I can't say that this is surprising.
It is a bit odd, though, considering that both Ramius and Ryan are largely motivated by the women in their lives. So it's like, yeah. Women are absent from being on screen, and yet their presence is what motivates them, because Ryan, I mean, as the family man, he wants to do the job, get home, and make sure he brings his daughter the teddy bear. And then Ramius, we later learn, like, his defection is a year to the day from his wife's death. And in a lot of ways, like, her death triggers sort of a personal reevaluation of what he's doing and whether or not the Soviet Union's plans for future warfare is something that he wants to get behind. So, yeah, that is a bit strange. And, I mean, yeah, when you consider the number of people involved in the film, we have a wife and a daughter that, as you said, disappear after 5 minutes. That does sound a bit weirder when you lay it out like that.
Well, and it's the thing. I mean, this is not the only film that McTiernan has like this. Because, again, the dude made Predator. Possibly the most film filled with the most machismo that you will ever see on screen. I mean, that's a film where you have Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jesse the Body Ventura, Shane Black, Carl Weathers.
I was going to say, wouldn't it be so weird if we discovered Jeffrey Jones was in Predator 2?
Oh, God.
Go on!
But yeah, but I think this thing, I mean, it's a thing, it's a problem with the movie in the sense that it's reflective of an overall cultural problem with Hollywood both then and now, as is the case. It's just, I mean, it doesn't necessarily impact this film on a narrative level because, again, I mean, it's not, the film doesn't have anything to say about gender per se or gender roles, as it were. So its problematics are in what it's in its absence, really, more than anything else.
Yeah, like, it's not consciously saying anything. I mean, I feel like implicitly there's something to the fact that, you know, it's 1990, Baldwin very much just kind of like that new man coming to prominence in Hollywood. And we've talked in previous episodes how there's sort of the... changing social roles and gender roles in society, there's this Hollywood backlash. You get your things like Rambo 3. But even like a film like Die Hard is sort of more in line with what's happening here, where, you know, I mean, Bruce Willis, yes, he is the action star, but a lot of the film is him grappling with learning to be a progressive male. And that doesn't quite happen to the same extent here, if and only if, because from the get-go, Ryan is sort of initially presented as already having completed that transition.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing.
But, I mean, you're right. This isn't a film that's trying to make any grandiose statements, and certainly no overt ones. But when you read it against its contemporaries, like, there is a statement being made, and... Again, though, it's like, well, we can look at how different male action stars can be and how men should act differently. But, you know, in spite of doing this, we still don't have any screen time for women.
Well, exactly. And again, I think it is, you know, a case where this is a film that, you know, sort of underscores the implicit biases of Hollywood itself and probably of Tom Clancy's work in general. Because, again, technically, yes, women get larger roles in his books. They're not written well.
Yeah, not terribly. I just remember the one environmentalist scientist who starts harvesting the Ebola virus. I'm like, I feel like you're working through some stuff, Tom. How's everything at home? Yeah, so I guess last aside though, there is also two things that I really want to get to about the film structurally. So earlier we mentioned that this film has the misfortune of being a story from 84, filmed in like 88, 89, released in 90. So it's kind of displaced that way. But the film opens by bracketing it off and saying, this takes place in 1984. But also, and I think it must have had to be included for the Navy to give support, like the opening intro titles talks about how in 1984, i.e. when the Cold War was happening, this Russian submarine was destroyed off the American coast, so on and so forth. None of this, none of what you're about to see ever happened. And like, it doubles down on being like, okay, this story isn't real, but even if it was, it happened a long time ago. So as a result, like, they're allowed to still have that kind of like rah-rah, we won the Cold War style narrative. But at the same time, like, mediating that by the fact that the film hinges on like a couple conscientious Russians doing the right thing. And that's very strange to me, just like that weird double framing of it, and that insistence, like the words never happened, remain on screen after the rest of it fades for a few seconds. And I guess really what I want to know is, what do you make of that, David?
To me, it never even occurred to me to take this as sort of, you know, something that might have happened to the Navy's insistence. I think it what it's, to me, it almost reads all in the opposite, where it's the idea of trying to give this film like a little more verisimilitude than it really deserves, or really needs, because it's that idea. It's like, oh, these are the events that were nobody wants to acknowledge happened, and give it that sort of sense of, you know, this is the true story, even though it's total fiction.
Yeah, like it's almost like a wink to the audience. But if they if they were trying to like frame the film as based on a true story, I mean, that would be very different. But yeah, here, like, it's almost like they, because they go out of their way to emphasize that this is a fictional account, it does almost have the opposite effect, where it's like, oh, so you guys are, you know, someone has a gun to your head and we swear none of this was real. But yeah, so I guess part of me wonders, like, in political terms, by sort of like giving the elbow to the audience and being like, by the way, this actually totally happened. And especially reading that in the context of 1990s geopolitics, I wonder, like, is this film more propagandist than it tries to be? Or than it thinks it actually is doing? Like, there's a level where it's operating beyond that. And I think, like, I feel in some way that even though this is, as we said, like a much more nuanced kind of Cold War spy film than its contemporaries, like, at the end of the day, thinking this morning about Tom Clancy, like, especially when you have young kids getting used to, like, his video games and stuff and getting used to his work, like, there is inherently going to be this sort of fetishization of American militarism. Whether you want to look at it in terms of we just have the coolest stuff, or, well, the good guys are on our side, and that. So the moment that you start filtering real history through it, I think that opens up spaces where it can be very problematic, or it certainly, it valorizes militarism by reducing everything to the level of Hollywood spectacle.
Well, there's no question, I think, when it comes to Tom Clancy himself, there's a reason he became the recruitment, you know, poster boy for, you know, he's not quite a, you know, he's not actually part of the Navy or the military or the CIA or anything, but hey, you know what he's presenting to you guys, totally, it's as cool as this. Come check it out. And whether that's more a byproduct of the film adaptations or Clancy's actual books or the games, whatever the case may be, you know, I don't know enough about the Clancy game canon or to be able to speak to it too much. But I totally buy that this would be much like any time Hollywood's done things. Like, again, Top Gun. I mean, there's a reason, you know, I would say Air Force recruitment went through, if I'm not mistaken, did end up, you know, surging post the release of that film, because yeah, that's a film that makes flying in, you know, an F-15 really friggin' cool. And why wouldn't you join up with that? And I would imagine, you know, again, if I'm not mistaken, I think the Navy had the same hopes when they agreed to participate in the making of this film, with the notion of, yeah, we, you know, we can drive up naval recruitment by making it look this awesome. Because guess what? You get to hang out with people as intense and cool as Sean Connery and Scott Glenn in this movie, as the case may be. Or you get to run multi-million dollar software and play around with it. I mean, there is that feeling of, and I mean, it gets us into the territory then of, is when you make films about the military or about anything like this, there's that question, I think, that goes back of, by making it, are you implicitly endorsing it, or, you know, making it appealing? Because I remember there was a prof I had who wasn't a film prof, but who insisted that film inherently beautified whatever it touched. And, you know, it inherently made it aesthetically appealing or, you know, implicit. And part of his argument was to try and note that, you know, books don't do that, which I find ridiculous.
Yeah.
And
if you watch a war film like Come and See, for instance, it's a lot harder to make that argument. If you're looking at through a narrowly North American context, that argument has more weight, but it's also, I think, oversimplifies. But go on.
But no, but I think it certainly does bring us to the question when it comes to films like this, because on one hand, you can't really make a movie like this without the involvement of the military. Because guess what? Odds are you're not going to be able to afford to build enough of a sub unless you're willing to blow, you know, well past a $30 or $40 million budget, as I think this film costs $30 to make from the figures I'd seen back in 1990 versus, you know, these $200 million blockbusters today in order to even remotely have access to the stuff. Whereas, yeah, if you play ball with the Navy or the Marines or whoever it is you're dealing with, they're going to let you play with their stuff to a degree and photograph it, as you know. So there is that trade-off of, are you making them look good or not? And it's,
well,
that is deeply problematic, and it's deeply troubling. At the same time, I would, part of me then looks at it when you look at a film like Hunt for Red October. Is it problematic? Absolutely. At the same time, I feel like the responsibility of the viewer to be able to look at this and recognize it for what it is and what it's doing becomes important, because I fear so much of this, the notion of, you know, these things act as recruitment tools or, you know, as valorization of the military. There is, you know, absolutely truth of this. What kind of always raises my eyebrows a little bit is there always seems to be this implicit notion with the argument that there is a segment of the audience that is gullible and played on, and we're not that, but we have to be concerned about how it's going to do it to those, to the rubes.
Yeah, those
in the
poor
audience.
Unfortunate souls, the Peoria crowd. But,
well, exactly. And I, on one hand, I get it, but I feel like that ends up going to some really problematic territory in terms of the arguments that you're going to make.
I mean, so. I feel like that sort of, the issue of valorization pretty much applies to any film. I only ask that here because on one hand, you have the figure of Tom Clancy inspiring the story for it. You also have the United States Navy involved with the making of it. It comes out right on the heels of the Berlin Wall falling, but at the same time, its own narrative is not so much like they are our enemy. It really, the film is kind of tries to give a message of like universalism, where regardless of nation, people are eventually brought together by the desire to do the right thing. And so I'm just, yeah, like, I feel like if the Navy wanted this to be a recruitment tool, then somehow that message got subverted. But at the same time, if it's a message about, like, sort of one world, you know, everyone united under reason and common sense, I feel like that also got compromised. So it's just a little odd, more than anything necessarily, like, actionable. The other thing that I did want to say, and blew my mind when I saw it, and I've been unable to think about anything ever since, the way that the film uses language and dialogue. Because, yes. I mean, we've all seen, you know, hundreds of movies where it's like, okay, well, this is a bunch of Tibetan warriors that all speak with impeccable British accents, you know? And there's the obvious, like, go-to criticism of, why is Sean Connery playing a Russian? And so the film begins, though, probably the first 5 to 10 minutes, all the scenes that take place on the boat are spoken in Russian, subtitled in English. And then it's only after, like, it basically, the moment that the plot really gets into motion, Connery goes below deck to meet with the political officer on the boat to read their orders from Moscow. And the officer is reading a book in Connery's study, and he's reading the excerpt still in Russian until he gets to the word Armageddon. And maybe it's because the word Armageddon is the same in both languages. And, like, it's sort of on the nose where it's like, well, we all have an interest in avoiding this. But from that moment onward, almost all of the dialogue on the Red October is in English. And that is so strange, because it's as if the film is being like, okay, we're going to take 10 minutes to fully establish that, yes, these are Russian people. They are speaking Russian. And then the moment that turn happens, it's almost like the film is saying, look, you all realize what we're doing here. We'll give you enough credit to understand that they are Russian. Now we will proceed so you guys can hear the film instead of reading it. And I have never seen anything like that occur in a film before. I don't know if I will ever see anything like that occur in a film since, but, like, I don't even know what to make of it beyond the fact that this is so clever, but it's to the point where it is almost displacing, because I just found myself marveling at, like, how did they think to do that, and why has nobody else ever thought to do that?
To me, I'm with you in the sense that it is an incredibly clever conceit. I love things. Because what I don't think you quite mentioned it there as well is that as the political officer is reading it, we're giving into this push in subjective POV shot right up to his lips.
Yes.
As he's doing it. And the film very much positions that we are suddenly, and, you know, we are suddenly being let into this. We are seeing the shift over because now we are in their sphere, we are in their space, and we as a Western audience are witnessing. And I think it does speak to the fact that this is very much a film aimed at Western English language speakers more than anybody else. But it is, in terms of getting around that conceit and allowing us to dive into this, I think is very clever. Because you get things such as, one of my favorite film viewing experiences with my father was Enemy at the Gates. And the reason that was the case, because my father, when we after we'd watch it, his opinion was, it's like, no, it was a really good movie. But I kept having to remind myself that English equals Russian in this case.
Yeah, because it's so weird to see Jude Law being like, hello, hello, comrade commissar.
Exactly. And that's the thing when you're looking at this, you know, this film, I mean, it sells the conceit. What makes it, what's even better is that suddenly, for the majority of this film, those who are capable of pulling a Russian accent off, in terms of how they're speaking, they do it. Those who can't, don't even try. And that mixture ends up working because there is that cognitive recognition that we're not seeing how they're actually saying it, because ostensibly, everything we're seeing is supposed to be in Russian still. They're not speaking with thickly accented English throughout. And yeah, no, it works remarkably well. And I think, again, McTiernan does try something similar where in The 13th Warrior, when you have, it's been years since I watched the film, but there's a moment where Antonio Banderas' character is basically traveling with a group that speaks in, I think it's Arabic. Okay. I may be wrong. Don't quote me. But he adds, you see, there's a close-up of him, and then you go from the close-up of him to his eyes as he starts watching these characters' lips. And you transition for enough times passed over where suddenly, you know, the switch over to English is the recognition that he has now mastered their language. And it doesn't, I don't remember it working nearly as well there as it does here. Maybe I'll have to rewatch that film and analyze that one in more detail, but no, you're right. It is a remarkably clever conceit. It's incredibly well pulled off.
Yeah, and I did not see that coming at all. Because, you know, I had never seen this film until I watched it for this episode. I know, bad film student. But, I remember the takeaway from everyone I know who had seen it. It was like, but Sean Connery tries to speak Russian. So when it started out subtitled, I'm like, what's going on? Oh, they just mean like he's speaking Russian dialect, but you can still hear the Scot. Got it. And then all of a sudden that happens, and I'm like, what, am I actually seeing this, or am I just thinking I'm seeing this? But it also allows them to do almost like a callback to that in the climax when Ryan and the crew of the Dallas finally board the Red October.
Yes.
Where all of a sudden they're speaking in Russian again, until Ryan reveals in Russian that he can speak a little bit of it, and almost like Connery like gives that smile and that nod, and he starts speaking in audible English again. And I think given the film's presentation of like sort of this universalist theme that, you know, deep down we are all humans trying to live on this world, I think it does allow the film to sort of push towards that more sort of utopian kind of takeaway of the ending, because again, it's establishing like, well, once you subtract, you know, languages out of the equation, like, you know, we all do understand one another. Of course, it's still problematic that the only language that, you know, the film hears for the most of it is English. Again, it's the Star Trek thing of, well, all these different cultures, and we decided that English was the one that we all needed to speak. But yeah, there are a couple shrewd little turns with that. And again, like, especially in the climax, I think it works so well, because the Russians are assuming that all the Americans are going to be ignorant. But then Ryan, it echoes so well that he's like the one person that understands the nuance of Ramius's actions. Because in this scene as well, he's showing, oh, by the way, I'm the one person that actually understands everything that you're saying. And through that, through both the narrative thrust and in that scene, that is partly how Ryan earns Ramius's trust and respect.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's, and that's the thing. Like, this film is, it's not a deep movie, but it is an incredibly cleverly constructed at both the level of its themes, at the level of it, the narrative itself, in terms of its structure. Like, this is just a smartly thought through film, you know, in terms of how it's executing, again, a pulp story, which could vary. I could easily have seen the version, you know, made, you know, in the early 1980s, where it's Roger Moore as Ramius, and it's, you know, much more, you know, 9 to 5, punch in, punch out, you know, we do our job and we get the hell off the stage, workmanship approach to it, which would probably be fine. But I think all that attention to detail here and the extra little thought that goes into it really pushes this one over the edge into being, yeah, I think arguably, I would put it, well, you know, alongside Die Hard, is one of the great sort of action thrillers that has been made, even though, unlike Die Hard, this is probably less of an action movie in terms of its, in terms of what it's doing.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this is a film that's concerned with protocol and procedure and operations and strategy much more than it's concerned with, like, the actual effects of those things. Because so much of the film is just characters trying to have a plan. And Ryan trying to be like, well, you don't need all these contingencies because this is actually what's going on. So plan for this. And yeah, like, but I mean, Ryan's own arc as a character is sort of the opposite because, you know, as he develops in the film, there are sort of maybe the two moments, I think, that really stand out. The one is when he is being airdropped to try and board the Dallas, the American sub that's following the Red October. And, you know, he's being dangled by this harness and they're trying to steer him to the boat and it's not working. And then there's that amazing shot from above where he just looks up and, like, you know, you can just see right into his eyes and he unhooks himself and drops into the water. It's like that's the moment where the civil servant becomes the action star. And then yeah. In the climax, again, there's sort of that paralleling where Rainius and co, they have to sort of maneuver the boat to avoid torpedoes being fired upon it, while Ryan has to track down the saboteur, and eventually he corners him, and they sort of have the stare down, and then he just opens fire. And, like, he kills one person in the film at the climax. Again, by, like, late 80s, 1990s body counts, that's almost, that's, like, nothing. But yeah, because of the way that Ryan's character has been presented and the way that he progresses through the film, when he makes that one kill, it is more significant to the audience and to the narrative than 100 faceless goons in the first 10 minutes of Commando.
No, absolutely. And I think that's one of the, again, you know, very telling that in terms of how it's staged, I mean, the camera work in that climactic, you know, sort of working through the sub and shootout sequence, it's the moment where the film suddenly feels most closely to McTiernan's prior Die Hard movie in terms of some of the shot compositions and Ryan crawling through the ducts. Very much, you know, it feels like, you know, you're watching Bruce Willis working his way through the air ducts of the Nakatomi Tower in that film.
Well, and steam and broken pipes everywhere made me think about Commando. Only Vernon yeah. Wells wasn't wearing a chainmail vest.
Yeah. But the thing about it is, you know, what do you, I mean, I think that ends up being kind of a nice subtle callback there, along with the shot at the very end of the movie, but we'll get there afterwards, where the idea of, again, it's almost like McTiernan's, it's not just that he's mimicking himself, I think, you know, unconsciously or consciously, but it ends up adding a nice, whether you think he did it on purpose or not, I think it's interesting how it does echo the John, respond almost to the John McClane action hero of Die Hard. Because again, this is a film where everybody, you know, Ramius's big fear is he doesn't want to get stuck with an American cowboy. You know, his fear is that he's going to end up having, you know, run into the Americans and they're going to be very much of the shoot first, ask questions later yeah. mentality.
People who will listen, but they won't understand.
Exactly. And it's funny, again, comparing to Die Hard, where you have a film where, again, the notion of being the cowboy and what that means is kind of baked into the text as well. And, you know, just adds this kind of weird, interesting figure of where does John McTiernan sit on this as a way? And I don't think I have an actual answer for that or, you know, opinion on it. It's just, it's a very unique how he's sort of evoking that in both films to very different affect, and as it were. But,
and I think maybe, because I'm realizing we could probably talk about this film for a few more hours, but I think overall that might explain why The Hunt for Red October works and sustains itself in ways that the follow-up films never do. And I think it's because in trying to make follow-ups, they're like, okay, well, what is the franchise? What is the blueprint for what a Jack Ryan movie is going to be? And they end up just funneling all of that through the lens of, like, mainstream action cinema while ignoring all the little peculiarities that McTiernan and co. have brought to this film. And so, I mean, like, it's still a competent story being told, but it's missing some of those little nuances or those little choices that make you just sit up and take notice. Like, as I remember with the other ones, it's like, well, they're perfectly fine, but they feel very formulaic, whereas this one feels like a film very much standing out in a crowded marketplace.
Well, absolutely, and that's the case. I think, again, they get more conventional. They become very much what Hollywood thinks a political thriller is circa the early to mid-90s. And, I mean, they have moments. I think Patriot Games has one brilliant scene where, towards the end of that film, Ryan is brought into a room where, based on information he's given, he witnesses a satellite raid on a camp where people are dying. And again, credit where credit's due to Philip Noyce in that film. There's when they do that sequence, you know, there's the version where they cut back and forth between what's happening at the camp and what's going on as Ryan's watching it. But they don't. He establishes so it's Ryan watching this satellite feed of, you know, figures, heat signatures in night vision, you know, moving through the camp and dying. And everybody's just sort of coldly taking it in and analyzing what's happening. And Ryan's, like, the only one who's recognizing people are dying because of information I provided. And that's the moment, the one moment in the Harrison Ford films where I say, okay, that gets it right. Nothing else really does, or at least feels quite as on point as that moment in any of the other films. Unlike Red October, which really, really, again, it really feels like a brilliant one-off that people mistook for being a franchise, or at the very least, mistook for being what could be a mainstream Hollywood franchise as Hollywood knows, understands them to be, which is big action films, Harrison Ford running away from firebombs, and, you know, he's got to kill a guy in a boat chase at the very end of the film while storm's raging around. Like, I mean, come on. Just, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's why I think in the notes you referred to this as an accidental franchise, where, because you're right, like, I'm trying to think, like, if you do the Ford films and then make Hunt for Red October, it doesn't quite work without some kind of different framing to explain why all of a sudden we have a young, bright-eyed Jack Ryan here. And then, like, because, you know, the Ford films almost establish the blueprint, and here's where it sort of gets complicated and expanded upon. But that doesn't quite make sense, but neither is what we're given. And the fact that this is a film that, yeah, had all these expectations of being a blockbuster, and while it delivered on that, like, there's no indication from the marketing that the takeaway that they would develop later films out of would be the character of Jack Ryan. Like, if anything, to approach this film blindly, you'd almost assume that we'll either have different films about the Red October, or we'll have different films about the ongoing adventures of Captain Ramius.
Well, and that's the thing. I remember being a kid, and I hadn't watched the films at this point, but they had these box sets where, you know, it would be the Jack Ryan movies. And on one hand, you would have, like, the Hunt for Red October picture with Sean Connery, and then you'd have Harrison Ford in Patriot Games or The Clear and Present Danger. And I remember looking at these things, thinking at it, and again, you know, being a dumb kid at this point in time, looking and going, it's like, okay, so is Harrison Ford supposed to be playing the same character that Sean Connery is?
Yeah.
Or is there something
else?
Like,
that would be wonderful.
Well, and that was the thing.
It was K-19 The Widowmaker.
Fair enough. But that's the thing. It's like, I'm looking at these things, and it's like, again, you know, there's nothing visually that seems to, you know, or marketing-wise or anything else that really links these films, unless you recognize that they're based on source texts by the same author and feature the same character, but the emphasis on in that first film is so alien to everything that came afterwards. I mean, you know, even at the very least in the case of the Pink Panther movies, like, I know Clouseau was never the focus in that original one. He's a side character, but, you know, Peter Sellers still showed back up for everything that came afterwards, or at least the majority of what came afterwards. I mean, you get the link there, and they make sure to play that up when they're advertising that first film. And they've never really done that with Red October. I mean, even today, like, the Blu-ray case I'm looking at, you know, yeah, Baldwin's image is finally on it. It's still Sean Connery with, you know, who's headlining. It's still Sean Connery who gets the dominant position on that box art, one way or the other. I mean, Baldwin's still kind of the afterthought in this, so.
Well, and I mean, like, even the way the film concludes, like, it really, it's pretty equal, but I mean, Ramius is definitely going to have the outsized importance, if by virtue of the fact that he's the one defecting, so he's the one that puts it all into motion. And even at the end, he's given that monologue of, you know, I both like it and I dislike it, because they're standing on the boat as, after everything's all well and good, they're going to hide the Red October in a main harbor somewhere. And, yeah, Ramius is just standing there and he's like, there's one question you haven't asked me. Why? And it's like, it comes off almost like when, you know, somebody's like, so, aren't you going to ask me about my new haircut? It's like, oh, did you get your haircut? Oh, this old thing? But he explains that his motivations were that when he realized that the Red October was designed to be a first strike silent nuclear sub, he realized what that it was intended to be used for, and he didn't want any part of it. I guess he's fine with nuclear proliferation just until they tell him to drive it. But, and the film ends with him quoting Christopher Columbus, and then Ryan telling him, well, welcome to the new world. So the way the film ends, it sort of, again, returns that importance onto the Ramius character. But again, yeah, it's just, I don't know, I don't, like, I honestly don't see how they could have sat down and plotted out a franchise based off of this film at the time they were making this film. Because so many of the choices just do not make sense.
Well, and it's the case. And I mean, it would be the kind of thing where, you know, even take, probably the closest equivalent I can almost think of is the Hannibal Lecter films, where when you look at what Silence of the Lambs does, you know, Lecter isn't the driving force of either of those first two books. He's a person that's in it. He's a character that's part of it, but he's not the franchise. And I think it's very telling when you look at what everything that came after that film, things radically shifted and radically changed.
Yeah. Well, simply compare Manhunter to Red Dragon, and you can understand how the success of the franchise dictates what future films are going to be like.
Exactly. And I think, you know, in this case, I mean, you know, it's very telling that I think if they had made Hunt for Red October, you know, if it, you're quite right, if they made it afterwards, you know, it'd be Harrison Ford, and then they'd have, you know, I don't know, playing Ramius, but it'd be somebody who, you know, they would cut down the Ramius section, amp up the Ford stuff, and then I don't even know who the heck you would cast to play Ramius at that point, but it would be somebody.
Klaus Maria Brandauer.
After that leg is recovered. But yeah, no, I mean, it would be a different beast of a movie, and honestly, a lesser film at the end of the day. So
yeah, I mean, this film, there's a lot going on. I feel like most of it works well. It might not be as quite as thrilling as it thinks it is, but I think it's also a lot more clever than most people would give it credit for on first glance. But being a film full of moving parts, though, David, I think it may be time that we steer the sub towards our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits.
Sounds good to me.
So, you pick the film, so you get the first hit. What's something that we haven't talked about, a slighter detail, that you really enjoyed?
Well, one thing we haven't really talked about, and we mentioned it briefly, is the score of this movie. And, you know, Basil Poledouris, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing his name correctly, I miss him. I love his... His work is bombastic, but it's bombastic in a way that's pleasant and enjoyable. I mean, he does these very muscular scores to these films that almost border on, at points, parodic in some ways. But it works here. Again, it gets that pulpy vibe without, you know... Like, again, not to keep comparing, you know, the film that comes after Patriot Games to this, but James Horner's score is so... dreary and melancholy and self-serious that you come to what Poledouris is doing here, and it's fun, it's pulpy, it's, you know, it keeps things energized and moving, and I don't think it gets, I mean, it's not as memorable as, say, the work he does in Conan the Barbarian or RoboCop or Starship Troopers, but I don't think it gets enough credit for being as good as it is, and it's kind of understandable given how many other major parts of this movie there are that are worth acknowledging. So kudos to that. How about you, Andrew?
I would say that I'm probably just going to pick some individual performances. I really, really liked Sam Neill in this film as the first mate, Barodin. He plays off of Connery really well. And again, like, his character isn't fleshed out terribly. He's certainly not one of the mains, but he has a couple little scenes, like the one where Ramius is addressing all of the officers about him sending the letter to Moscow to effectively burn their bridges and that. And, like, you know, everybody's dismissed, and then Barodin comes back, and he basically sits down and he's like, I respect you way too much to ever disagree with you in front of everybody, but we need to talk. And, like, he comes off as not subservient, but dedicated, and, like, you know, and again, like, not even necessarily, we've talked about latent homoeroticism in other films, and, like, I feel like it would almost be too easy to play that. Instead, it's just two men with a deep admiration for one another while also having a power imbalance. But he delivers the one little monologue that I really liked later when they're talking about what happens if they succeed and they get to America. And Broding just imagines his life, you know, moving to Montana and getting married and buying a recreational vehicle and just driving from one end of the state to the other and not having to show his papers to anybody. And like, he delivers that speech really well, but it's also a really well-written speech because in very simple terms, anybody seeing this in the theater, they immediately can understand just one of the central differences between living in the Soviet Union and living in America and like those little freedoms that everybody takes for granted. And not to make too much of that scene, but I just really enjoyed how it played off. And it made the fact that, you know, Broden ends up dying before he can see Montana, sniff, that just makes it even sadder. What about you, Dave?
Why we're still on this love train towards the performances. Again, we mentioned Tim Curry earlier. And the thing about Curry is, you're right, he's giving an ostensibly straight performance. He's still quasi bordering on comic relief, though, in terms of his
Tim Curry. I mean, his eyebrows alone are a sight gag.
Yeah. And it's the thing. I love the fact that he's, it's not that he's dim necessarily. It's not that he isn't unintelligent. It's just that he's just, you know, loyal enough to the Soviet Union like a puppy that, you know, and everybody knows just to treat him. It's like, just give him just enough respect that he doesn't question anything, and then still, you know, kick him to the curb whenever we need to. That works out remarkably well. And again, I think it speaks to the sort of notion of the heightened reality that this film takes place in, where you can get performances that walk right up to being very broad, because it's Tim Curry. Yeah, he'll be very broad from time to time. And, you know, it fits. It never feels tonally out of place. Likewise, again, Richard Jordan, you know, with that wonderful speech he gives Ryan when he tells him to stick around in the room afterwards. And he starts talking about what it's like to be a politician there. And he's just got this, like, you know, there's like this childlike glee in his eye as he's going through. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm a politician. Yeah, I'm basically playing both sides against the other, so I have options here. But I'm going to give you enough rope to hang yourself, if the case may be. But you might just save our behinds in this as well. And even his interactions, again, with Josh Ackland, particularly at the end of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I love the line he gives with Ryan, where he's like, all these other guys, they can't do the job, but you're... And then Ryan finishes, I'm expendable. And then they just have that sort of, like, knowing look at one another, and you're like, well, you got me. The scenes with the ambassador, especially right at the end, where he explains that, well, we've lost the boat, and then the ambassador's like, oh, there was also another boat dispatched to the area to try and take down the Red October. We haven't heard from that in a few days. And Jordan just waits the exact right amount of time while eating hard candy, and he just turns, takes off his glasses, and says, oh, Andre, you've lost another submarine?
Exactly.
I just died. Because that diffuses it right there. And, like, through all of the scenes with Pelt, like, he shows that regardless of what he genuinely thinks or believes, he is expert at using the language of politics and diplomacy. And so, like, especially the ambassador scenes, like, there's this tension because both of them are sort of playing their own angle, but they're meeting in the middle and using the official, respectable speech that one must give to one another. And so even at the end, like, the ambassador clearly knows that Pelt knows more than he's letting on, but because he's saying all the right things, there's nothing that anybody can do about it.
Exactly. It's just, oh man, it's a delightful, and again, it's not a big part of the film, it's just these quick little cutaways, but they work so well and inject a little bit of humor in where needed into this movie.
Yeah. And the sense that, you know, it's the government working. It's not just the one brave man who's putting all of this in motion. Like, there's an entire complex network of operators behind every single thing that happens in the movie. So those cutaways help remind us that this is not just an event happening in isolation.
Well, exactly, and I think that's probably the biggest thing that the sequels lose, is that notion of, you know, there is that larger world, there is that larger network of people who have to interact and work together, particularly by the time you get to Shadow Recruit, when it's just, this is Jack Ryan, and, you know, he's our go-to guy, and we're gonna put him in the field, and he's gonna do everything, and it's like, okay, come on, that's, you know, not to sit there and say that Clancy was without his faults, but I mean, he would have written something a little bit better than this. But
so maybe that could steer us to any pits you have for this film. I know we've said a lot of glowing things about it, but if there are any minor irritants or even major ones that we haven't talked about yet.
I gave, you know, John McTiernan credit early on for being able to keep all the sort of plot, moving parts and plot strands in line. But still, there is one teeny tiny exception to that, however. And we never mentioned Stellan Skarsgård being in the film.
I'm glad you said that, because I think we have the same pit.
Yeah, because Skarsgård basically plays this quickly established, you know, basically...
He's
young
a student
officer, but,
of Ramius.
Ramius, who is an egotist and wants to, you know, basically figures that if he takes out Ramius, that's going to make him, like, the top dog type thing. And he shows up for, like, one scene, gets angry about the fact that, you know, their orders were delayed to go hunt the Red October, and then doesn't show back up until the end of the film. And it's fine. Like, you remember who he is, but it feels so much like, you know... The reason Skarsgård's playing him as broad as he is to make him stand out. And he's he's the one character that sort of steps over into cartoonishness in terms of...
I mean, the fact that he's, like, standing there scowling and, like, smoking in a submarine, which I don't think is a good thing to do, but, like, even the way he delivers his lines, because, like, he's since had many different roles in various international productions. So it's not that he can't deliver lines naturalistically, but like everything he says here kind of comes off like he's snarling, like, "Oh, there goes Ramius. We're going to take him down." And it's like, it's just unpleasant to listen to and comes off as really, really over the top.
Well, and that's the thing. And it's, I mean, you're right. Skarsgård is a really good actor and can do, you know, has been better in other films. But here, I get it. I can understand you don't want to spend too much time with him because who cares what's going on with him? He has a role to function in terms of how this film's going to resolve itself at the end.
Yeah, like his role really is to be introduced so we remember him when he pops out the climax, gives us a little bit more tension, and then blows himself up in like the most blasé way possible. Not in the sense that the tremendous explosion is not satisfying, but eventually what ends up happening is like the Red October maneuvers in such a way that the torpedo ends up locking back onto the submarine that fired it. And as it's coming back, there's just that line, I think it's 80 yard, where one of the crewmen is just like, "Look what you've done. Your ego has destroyed us all." And it's just, well, that's the end of me. It feels so low impact, given the fact that everyone just realized that they're all about to die.
Yeah, no, it is. It's the one, I would say, fairly significant misstep in an otherwise really tightly constructed film. But, you know, credit where credit... I mean, if that's your biggest problem in the film, I'd say that's a hell of a victory. But what about you, Andrew? Any other things that are... sort of pits for you as far as this film's concerned?
Just trying to think. I mean, like, the film does feel like a bit of a slog, only because it's over 2 hours and it's very technical at times. But, I mean, that's offset by the fact that the film presents it in a fluid and interesting way. I'd say the biggest stretch in plausibility, though, is also believing that Alec Baldwin is a loving and attentive father. that was a bridge a little too far. I think it's also just the fact that, like, the first 10-15 minutes of the film is really going to be kind of a litmus test where Because in that first 10-15, we have the linguistic shift, we have that odd framing of the narrative, and also, like, before we learn anything about Ramius, we see him go down into his cabin and straight up murder his officer with his bare hands. So there's a lot of weird little shocks, and then after that, once the plot, like, reveals itself and the film gets set on course, I think it sticks to its formula a lot more closely. But I would say that, like, especially if you're going into this for the first time, that first 15 minutes may be enough to put you off of it. Hopefully it won't, though, because, the 2 hours that follow it is actually really interesting. What about you, David? Any other quibbles?
Minor nitpick, and it's one of those things where if in a film it's a minor Hollywoodism, but towards the end of the film, when the in the climax, when the all the stuff with the fake or the Americans launching a torpedo to simulate the notion of basically this distracting theater so that the crew of the Red October that's gotten off the ship believes that the Americans and the Red October crew or officers are fighting one another. You see that the missile is destroyed before it reaches the Red October. It's pressed by, Deputy Director Greer, who's magically there along with the scumbag Jeffrey Jones as his character. And he delivers that line. It's like, the missile blew up on its own. We were never here. Also, it's like, okay, I guess it's nice to see him pop up, but you didn't really need to have them there. Like, there's
Yeah,
not.
anyone could have pressed the button, but then we would have lost out on the Men in Black line.
Well, and that's exactly it. And it's just sort of like, I mean, hey, I'm not complaining about having more screen time for James Earl Jones. Of course, if you have James Earl Jones, bring him in. But, I mean, it's very, very. It's a minor quibble otherwise in an otherwise pretty tight film. How about you? Any other last sort of things?
Oh, I'm just trying to think here. I have one on the tip of my tongue, but I think that about covers it. If I think of anything, I'll just tack it onto our Twitter feed,
No.
and all 5 people that follow me can argue about it with themselves. But yeah, so I mean, on the whole, it sounds like I think you and I can both agree. For a film that seems like it could very easily be stock genre, how we won the Cold Warfare. The film is doing a lot more interesting things than that, and when it succeeds, and it largely does, it's quite successful.
No, absolutely. So yeah, I would say it's highly recommended for people to check out. Certainly, there's any number of places you can get your hands on a copy of this one, so it's not difficult to find. So do definitely check it out. But having said that, Andrew, I think it's time that we sort of move on and discover where are we heading to next? What glorious ways are we going? Are we following Sam Neill somewhere? Are we following, say, I know Josh Ackland to some movie? Where are we going?
Well, as much as I would like to see how many episodes we can get out of Richard Jordan in a row, I am actually going to take us somewhere a little bit different.
Okay.
Now, for those of you who have been listening to the show for a while, when David and I started, Dave gave me a list of 5 or 6 films that would make interesting first episodes, and we ended up picking One from the Heart. And then deciding if we could get back to these at any point, we would try our best to. And with that spirit in mind, I am proud to announce that through Sean Connery, we are going to be following our film's trip to our next episode, the infamous Highlander 2, The Quickening, Russell Mulcahy's lost non-masterpiece, and widely regarded as one of the most problematic productions ever to face a Hollywood film, resulting in what is universally regarded as one of the very worst films ever made. So that's what we're going to be taking a look at next episode, and I think we may end up have another hitchhiker on the way with us.
I believe so. If all the scheduling works out, that will definitely be the case. So yeah, that'll be man, I am looking forward to getting into the Highlander 2. Merc, it is a It's an interesting one, folks. But yeah, so until then, Andrew, where if people want to contact you with their thoughts and commentary on the Red October, or, you know, be a deep Russian agent who wants to criticize us for challenging the great Soviet Union, where can they contact us?
Yes, disclaimers. Posting anything about this film, you may get followed by a whole lot of bots, but that's okay. Everybody likes being popular. You can find me on Twitter at FilmsTripper, and you, Dave?
I'm at 24Panels. Notably, you'll find much, much, much geeky commentary and discussions going on there about things such as Beastmaster and what happens in Beastmaster.
I mean, the two most pressing questions in anyone's life. Yeah. As well, you can find our podcast. We update once a week through iTunes or your favorite podcasting service. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to leave a rating and review. 5-star reviews are the best way to get new eyes on the product. But at the same time, honesty is important, and if you don't tell us what you dislike, then we can't do anything about it. So head on over there. We believe that all publicity is good publicity. And yeah, any parting words, David?
I believe it's you who usually has the parting words.
Oh, yes. How silly of me. Remember, everybody, until next week, that adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
But you...
Unless, go ahead.
I was just going to say, sometimes maybe you just want to put it in a memo, but...
Or sometimes a redirected homing torpedo will do it first.
Yeah. Bye, folks.